Hello, listeners. My name is Kyle Shoup. I'm a PhD student in the Department of Sociology at the University of Cincinnati, and I hold a master's degree in women's gender and sexuality studies from the same university. Broadly speaking, I'm interested in the sexual identities, communities, and practices of queer men, especially as they relate to masculinity and social differentiation. Here I'll be presenting a historical analysis that I've titled Cruising the Docks, Shipyards as Sites of Queer Men's Sexual Solicitation. Before I dive in, I do want to provide a note on terminology. In this talk, when I'm referring to queer men, I mean men who engage or want to participate in sexual activities with other men. This definition of queer does not necessarily imply that sailors have a gay identity, but it doesn't exclude the possibility either. We don't know how these men understood their sexuality or their motivations for sex with other men, but we do know they sometimes engaged in these sexual activities. Sexual solicitation refers to the social practices that are used to identify potential partners and facilitate sexual encounters with them. And cruising is a specific form of sexual solicitation used by these men to attract sexual partners, which primarily relies on nonverbal communication and relative anonymity between partners. Today I'll be discussing how the docks became a site of sexual solicitation for queer men. I argue that as the surveillance and regulation of Navy sailors' sexual activities became increasingly controlled, and as dominant understandings of homosexuality shifted from deviant sexuality to a threat of national security, sailors largely avoided sexual encounters with their crewmates at sea in favor of anonymous sexual encounters with civilian men at the docks. These events fostered a new sexual community located at the docks. This transformation of sailors' sexual lives occurred over hundreds of years. In my review of the histories of British and American navies through the 1600s to the 1700s, I found no shortage of reports of sailors having sex with shipmates and cabin boys. In response, naval services implemented harsh policies forbidding deviant sexual behavior, termed buggery. These policies were enforced by naval officers, except when they were participating in these acts, and to be found guilty of homosexual conduct could carry a death sentence. To manage sailor sex drives and discourage homosexual activity, naval services implemented policies that allowed some women sex workers on board ships, especially when in port. While prostitution and non-marital sex with women were generally regarded as immoral sexual practices, they were treated as the lesser of two evils when compared to homosexual buggery, and therefore tolerated. Historians reporting these instances of deviant sexual practices tend to downplay them as rare occurrences, not indicative of the average sailor's experience, or sensationalize them as the sordid details of men's lives at sea. While it's impossible to know how frequently sailors had sex with other men, these narratives illustrate that sex between sailors did occur, and presumably more often than men were caught, dismissed, or even executed for it. While the punishments for buggery are barbaric by contemporary standards, disciplinary actions were irregular and the consequences varied for sailors based on situation, rank, or other reasons. However, over time, naval services' perceptions of homosexuality shifted from that of immoral sexual practice to threats of national security, and the scrutiny for the newly defined category of conduct unbecoming increased as the punishments for sex between sailors became uniformly enforced. In the U.S., this transformation occurred during the 1900s. While a full review of the repression of homosexuality and discrimination against queer men in the U.S. military is outside of the scope of this project, it directly influences the emergence of the docks as a site of sexual solicitation for queer men. So I'll be providing a broad overview of how these events unfolded. For listeners interested in a comprehensive history, I'd recommend Randy Schilt's book, Conduct Unbecoming. Beginning in World War I, consensual sodomy in the military was defined as a criminal act, and military officials drawing on the burgeoning field of psychiatry began barring men with homosexual orientations from service, characterizing them as ineffective fighters. In the Red Scare of the 1940s and 50s, queer men were depicted as security risks and potential traitors, whose deviant sexual practices made them vulnerable to blackmail by communists. In the 1980s, the purge of queer men from the U.S. military was at its height, with over half of discharged men being formerly enlisted Navy sailors. This history culminates with the 1994 Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy that prohibited discrimination against closeted soldiers while banning those, quote, demonstrating a propensity or intent to engage in homosexual acts for creating an unacceptable risk to the high standards of morale, good order, and discipline, and unit cohesion that are the essence of military capability, end quote. And Don't Ask, Don't Tell was later repealed in 2011. The success of this purge was dependent on the methods used by U.S. military officials to identify and sanction queer men. Interrogations of suspected homosexuals were often hostile, and investigators routinely used techniques reserved for habitual criminals to solicit confessions of policy violations. In addition, investigators demanded the names of other enlisted queer men with a promise of leniency, whether true or false, for those who named names. The pressure to cooperate encouraged queer men to betray their partners and friends to protect themselves from harsh punishments. The consequences of forced resignations, dishonorable discharges, and courts-martial were immense. Queer men faced damage to their reputations, the end of their careers, problems with future employment, the loss of health, financial, and educational benefits provided by the military, strained or even severed relationships with their families and friends, homophobic harassment or violence, possible imprisonment, and innumerable other harms. As the surveillance and punishment of homosexuality in the U.S. Navy intensified over time, queer sailors altered their sexual practices to reduce their risks of exposure. While these practices did not fully liberate them from the gaze or discipline of the U.S. Navy, queer sailors with their civilian counterparts developed several strategies to limit the possible consequences of sex between men, including having sex when on leave, having sex with non-enlisted men, and having anonymous non-committal sex facilitated by cruising. Sailors' actions moved sex from the ships to the docks, creating a new sexual community with unique actors, locations, motivations for participation, and rules of engagement. With this move, the docks emerged as a site of sexual solicitation where queer sailors and civilian men would meet in bars, bathrooms, or on the beach. Queer men were able to identify and attract one another by cruising, which involves searching for potential partners in an area known to be cruisy, moving in view of or physically close to a potential partner, signaling interest with nonverbal communication like a lingering gaze or using a pickup line, such as, "Do you come here often?" and finally negotiating a time and place to meet for sex. While my review of cruising practices here is cursory, I would point interested listeners to Martin Levine's book, Gay Macho, for a comprehensive analysis of this form of sexual solicitation. The docks, then, are not just a site where cruising may occur, but a setting that enables sexual solicitation between men. As John Hollister argues, cruising is not just a repertoire of techniques. It cannot be separated from the locations where it takes place. Use of conducive space is central to all cruising. In response to the punitive policies against homosexuality in the U.S. Navy, queer men co-opted the docks as a space for sexual solicitation, inventing a set of social practices that the initiated can use to find sexual partners. Those not in the know cannot cruise the docks because the space is not sexualized to them. And men unaware of proper cruising protocol risk failure in locating sexual partners, or even discovery by fellow sailors or Navy informants. For these Navy sailors and civilian men, cruising only works at the docks because they recognize it as a space of sexual possibility, and they understand the rules to successfully navigate it.